Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
And today, of course, it's me, Al Warren, and I've got Michael Hawley as well.
Hello again.
The Ripper.
The Ripper guy.
He's the Ripper. And I don't mean Jack. I mean, you can't sit in a studio with him for very long.
Well, I got to keep my distance from him, but that's my way of social distancing.
I guess. Well, you need a lot more than 6 feet, that's for sure. Today, we're doing a lot of Ripper now because that's the thing to do. Seems to be a lot of interest. And so I've been going through the list and trying to find people that are writing or being involved in the Ripper history and different parts of it. So we've got another guest that does that. And his book is Inside Buck's Row. Now, it's Marianne Nichols, An Anatomy of Murder. And from what I understand, it's it's book one of a project, and we'll ask him about that. So on the line, we've got Stephen Blomer. Thank you for being here.
Good evening. Nice to be here.
So nice speaking with you, Steve.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mike.
Grab a coffee. No, the first of all, let's start. How did you get interested in Jack the Ripper and the Whitechapel murders?
Oh, we go back many years now. We go back to the 1960s. My late grandfather was born just after the murders, and I lived in the same house as him, and he used to tell me as a little boy stories about this mythical Jack the Ripper type character. So I've got an early interest. Then in 1973, when I was 13, the BBC did their Bardo and Watt docudrama thing, and that got me really interested. And then over the years, I went in and out of checking on the Ripper and studying the Ripper. My other main interests were Egyptology and politics. Then I took early retirement from a life in medical research in 2014, and I'm now a full-time writer, researcher on Jack the Ripper.
So now this project you've got, okay, Anatomy of Murder, and it's the Whitechapel Murders Project, Book 1. What does that mean? So you're doing a Whitechapel Murders Project. What are you doing? What's this whole series about?
The series is looking at, well, initially it's looking at the five canonical murder sites and the murders that took place there. I'm not actually doing it in chronological order, surprisingly enough. The next book is on Mitre Square. It's just because I'm doing it in the order which interests me. So Mitre Square will be next. then Hanbury Street, then Berners Street, then Dorset Street. Then we'll have another one, which is all of those who might have been victims. And that will be volume 6.
Mm. So each one is covering a murder. And this first one is Mary Ann Nichols.
Yeah.
So you're basically going over it in detail, the actual murder, the murder site, and everything.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, one of the things I like about this is, and I'm glad that Steve, you're here to talk about this, because when we look at all the ripperology in all aspects, there is a lot of misinformation that gets passed on, and then almost becomes fact. And then so it's great to have somebody get into the research and the detail about each specific one. So, and in this case, there's a couple things with Polly Nichols that we had the same thing. So it's exciting.
Good.
So let's start in with this. And maybe explain who was Mary Ann Nichols and how did she end up being one of the victims?
Mary Ann Nichols was a lower middle class at one stage, perhaps upper working class is more accurate, woman, had a real problem with alcohol from an early age, had a marriage that went wrong, the husband left her, she then drifted into casual prostitution on and off. It was more to do with the alcohol, the fact she couldn't hold down a job. She did get a job in 1888, but it didn't last long because she absconded from the house in Wandsworth with some clothing and other possessions from the family. She ended up drifting to Whitechapel, where she stayed for around 3 or 4 weeks, from what we can tell, before she unfortunately one night went out and met the Whitechapel murderer.
And she had 5 children too, right?
Yes.
Maybe describe, you know, because listeners that don't understand, what was London like at the time of the murders, and what was this Whitechapel area like? Maybe give us a description.
At the time, London was, without doubt, the centre of the world. It was the largest city in the world. It had a massive population compared to other cities in the world. You had divided into the West End, which was the upper class area, places like Chelsea, Knightsbridge, Marble Arch, Buckingham Palace, around that way. Then you had the city itself. The city of London is a very small, peculiar bit. It's a mile square, and it's the centre of the finance industry in Britain. And then to the east of that, bordering on it, touching it, is what's called the East End. This was much more run-down, slums, 80,000 people living in a very small area, very high immigrant population at the time, which hasn't changed, just different immigrants now in that area. Now it's Bangladeshis. Back in the 1880s, it was mainly Jewish immigrants from the pogroms in Europe. In some streets, the population was 90-95% Jewish. People, there weren't jobs going. People did what they could when they could. Many women, it appears, turned to what we would call casual prostitution rather than work as a prostitute. They did what they had to do to survive, basically. Many people were living in doss houses. They rented a bed or a space out at night. If they didn't have the money for that, they were out on the streets. Simple as that.
So what happened then with Mary Ann Nichols? If she was she living that way particularly?
She was at the end. She spent a lot of her life, I say, she originally got married fairly young. She lived south of the river at that age in what were the new Peabody estates. These were up and coming estates meant for poorer people, but much better conditions than they'd been used to. They weren't slums. Unfortunately, her relationship with her husband broke down, possibly because he was having an affair with another lady in the area, also possibly because of her drinking as well at the same time. She then drifted, basically, spent a lot of time in and out of the local workhouses, Lambeth Workhouse and various others, spent many months in those in and out. She was then apparently involved in some trouble in Trafalgar Square around the time of what was referred to as Bloody Sunday in late 1887, when troops were called out for a demonstration. She was a woman who could take care of herself. As I said earlier, in early 88, she was, the workhouse found employment for her in the Wandsworth area as a housemaid, but she absconded with property from the house, almost certainly because of her drinking habit, ended up in the East End, drifted between one or two separate DOS houses. On the night of her death, she'd spent her money, which she needed for her bed, several times. She was last seen by another lady who may well have been a casual prostitute as well, we're not sure. At around about 2:30, a body was found just over an hour later.
So that that would be Emily Holland was the lady that
yes.
saw her, and that was 2:30.
Yes.
And then
2:30 yes.
So yeah, I like how you said that 2:30-ish. And then we have I'd say 3:15 is when we have one patrol constable walking Butch Road, did not see anything.
Yes.
And then, but then soon after that was when we have two people seeing her body. Could
yes.
you go through
we have,
a little bit?
Yes. PC John Neal was a member of J Division of the Metropolitan Police. Buck Rowe was on his beat. He went through at approximately 3:15. 3 in the morning, he saw nothing. Sometime between 3:30 and 3:45, two carmen, that's delivery guys, walking from the east to the west, going down Bucks Row, came across the body of Mary Ann Nichols lying outside of a yard. They basically looked at her, were concerned, went off to find another police officer, found one, but in between times, John Neal had come back round and found her body before the other police officer arrived at the scene.
Okay, okay. And then I think that Dr. Llewellyn was there soon, real fast. They got a hold of him real fast to check out the body.
Yes, I mean, if we assume that basically the body's found approximately about 3:40, 3:45 by the police. Llewellyn is there around about 4:00. He only lives approximately 5-6 minutes away from the scene. So it looks like if the body's found at 3:45, second police officer is signaled, comes down the road, goes off to get Llewellyn, comes back with Llewellyn. We're looking at around about any time between 3:55 and 4:05. But the times are the important thing here because people take these times as being absolutes. Someone says, I saw this at 3:45, I did this at 3:40. They're not absolutes. There was no synchronized time. Everyone's watch, if they had one, was different to everybody else's watch. People may have gone from clocks in the street or on churches, but these wouldn't be synchronized. Basically, my view is that all the times that are given in any Ripper case are just estimates, and you can probably allow for 2 or 3 minutes either way as a bare minimum, and possibly up to 5 minutes either way as a bare minimum.
Right, right. So what's interesting also with this case is, I mean, forensics was not around much. I mean, they just took that body away, didn't they?
Yes, it was just picked up, placed onto what was termed an ambulance, which was basically just a handcart. Street was washed down at the same time with buckets of water. If anyone's seen the Michael Caine film where buckets of water are being thrown onto the pavement to clean it away, that's actually very close to what actually happened. There was nothing was recorded. When Llewellyn came there, he took no notice of the scene at all. It was basically, she's dead, onto the car, move it off as soon as possible.
Okay. Then, so that Bucks Row, now on the other side of that, the Whitechapel Road, was the London Hospital around
yes.
that area, correct?
Yeah, it's approximately a 5 minute walk from Bucks Row.
Okay. And then, so we have this case, and then what to me is really also intriguing about the Polly Nichols murder is because of the two previous unfortunates that were murdered, Smith and also Martha Tabram. They were already assuming that this was a series kind of killing going on, and in a lot of cases, this might be the first one.
Yes, the press were assuming that immediately. The police, I'm not so convinced, were linking all three together immediately. They were within a day or so, but I don't think at the time itself. I think when they first found the body laying there, I don't think there was any linkage at all at that stage. When Inspector Spratling arrived at the scene and when Inspector Helson arrived at the scene, I don't think anyone was thinking this is linked to other murders. This was just a run-of-the-mill murder. It wasn't until they got to the mortuary and realised just what had happened to her that things took off, shall we say.
So at the mortuary, what did they find?
Well, apparently all they'd seen at the site was that her throat had been cut. Llewellyn had carried out a very perfunctory inspection of her at the site and hadn't noticed that her intestines were protruding. For many people over the years, they've tried to claim that she had very minor cuts to her. She was all but eviscerated. Mm-hmm. The killer had been interrupted and just hadn't actually taken her intestines out of the body cavity at all, as he did in other cases such as Chapman and Eddowes. The cuts had all been made, it just hadn't been completed. It was only when they got her to the mortuary and started to undress her and clean her up that they noticed that she'd been basically cut right open.
So if and this is where I agree with you too, is that it looked like the offender probably was interrupted, and so the business he was not interrupted, we might have seen some organs taken possibly.
Yes. In fact, one researcher who's well known, Tom Westcott, has suggested that perhaps organs had been taken. I don't agree with Tom on that, and he's not 100%. It's like he's just suggesting that possibly something had been done. And it just was missed. Because at the inquest, the coroner, Wayne Baxter, asked Llewellyn to go back and check, basically, that nothing was missing, which suggests Llewellyn hadn't actually checked properly in the first place.
Right. And then especially since the next one, Annie Chapman, it was completely apparent that the womb was taken.
Yes. So that one had been completed. It looks to me basically as if Nichols was within 30 seconds of being in the same situation as Chapman.
So with that case, then we have the patrol constable not seeing anything. And then soon after we have both the carmen coming. Charles LaCrosse or Leachmere, and then Robert Paul. And did they come together or did they meet there or how did that work?
This is a very interesting point. The Leachmere has become a suspect for several researchers, and there's a television documentary which pushes him to a great extent. It's all about timings here, how far he was in front. Leachmere was in front of Paul. It's just a question of how far he was in front. The television documentary tries to argue he was 9 minutes in front, which is that conclusion is reached by taking a time which Rob Paul gives of leaving, arriving in Bucks Row at exactly 3:45 and taking a timing which Leachmere gives of leaving home around 3:30 and turning that into exactly 3:30, and they're allowing for the walking distance, which is about 6 to 7 minutes, depending on the exact route Leachmere would have taken, you're left with 9 minutes. They try and argue that if Leachmere had been within sight of Robert Paul, Robert Paul must have seen him if they'd been within a short distance. But if one actually looks at the distances on a map and checks them, Leachmere could have been passing the bottom of Robert Paul Street in Foster Street, 45 yards ahead of him, and not been seen until he's only 30 or 40 yards away from the body, in fact. It all depends on what speeds they're walking at and exact position they are. But unfortunately, there are researchers who try and push that Leachmere is there much sooner before, when in reality, he's probably only 30 or 40 seconds in front of Robert Paul at the most.
Right, right. I always curious too. I think In the case of with the Scotland Yard or just the detectives, local detectives there, to me, because they didn't have DNA or didn't have fingerprinting or whatever, one of the things that they would really focus upon are eyewitness accounts, those that are around. I think they would have looked at Leachmere and Robert Paul quite closely and probably, to me, would have discounted them quite in that case, too.
Well, we do know that Robert, I mean, unfortunately, the police records are non-existent, or whether they were interviewed or not. But we do know from a later report in the Lloyd's Weekly Press that Robert Paul was interviewed at some length by the police. He says they came, took him from his home to the police station. He was interviewed at some length. I think it's inconceivable that the same didn't happen to Leachmere. Unfortunately, the proponents of Leachmere argue because there's no record that he was interviewed, then we can't say he was interviewed.
So you're saying absent of evidence is evidence for absence, which is BS.
Yes, basically, so, yes. That's the argument which they use all the time, unfortunately.
Gotcha. I see. So, and then the connection with Polly Nichols definitely came. Scotland Yard took him seriously after a week later when Annie Chapman's murder was very similar.
Yes, yes, and the fact that it's quite possible that Leachmere would have walked past Chapman's site of Chapman's murder on his way to work. We can't be sure about this. What we do know is that he walked past there with Robert Paul on the morning of Nichols' murder, but that's because he was walking with Robert Paul. He may have taken a different route if he hadn't been walking with Robert Paul. At that stage, I'm sure the police would have really checked at that stage.
Right, right, right.
I think it's inconceivable that you've got this man who you know has walked that direction, another murder takes place, and you don't check him out. I think it's completely inconceivable that that happens.
Right. So then after this one, you said you're not going to go to, you're going to go to Catherine Eddowes' murder as your next?
Yes, Mitre Square. Right? That's a much larger book, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
A lot more work. It's not going to be out until November next year. The Bucks Row book, though it's an e-book, it's the equivalent of 575 pages at present. The Mitre Square book, we're looking at over 1,000.
Well, I can see why, because there's so much detail with that. And there's so little, actually, with Polly Nichols, with even eyewitness accounts. Yes. And but we see more. But I have a question: is why did the format you chose, the ebook, what kind of advantages or disadvantages were you just to choose that?
Main advantage is that you can link in outside information much easier. In a traditional book, you look at references and you go to the back. You see a footnote, you go to the back, and then you've got to go and try and find it. With an ebook, you click on the reference. It takes you to either to an internal part where the reference is given. I include many pages of witness statements in the appendices of Inside Bucks Row. Or it takes you to external sites, takes you to specialist history sites or Wikipedia sites if it's something which is not too contentious, or just takes you all over the place. We link into Casebook.org, JTR forums. We link into Richard Jones's sites. We link into to many sites, quite honestly, and it makes it far easier for someone just to check and see what's going on. It also there's also another problem, which I'm sure a lot of us have found, and that's issues of copyright on maps. When you do it as an ebook, and as long as you link directly to the site, there's no copyright issue. I have over 100 sketch maps which I've done myself in the book, but for period maps, I've got a whole appendices, a whole chapter, which links to something like 70 or 80 separate offline maps. Some are the Goad maps, some are held in the British Library, some are held at libraries in the United States. But these all link in, so it gives the reader a far fuller picture, and it actually it's aimed at researchers to an extent. I started off writing this from a research point of view to as an aid for researchers, and it's grown from that. But it's much easier if you're researching, say, to cut and paste than to have to sit down and transcribe.
Right.
The disadvantage is, the major disadvantage is that a lot of people don't like ebooks. And a lot of people still want a physical print book. Now, I am working on converting this across, but it's not a straightforward conversion, obviously, because a lot of what is in the ebook won't work and is irrelevant in a physical book. So that's quite a long process of rewriting it.
Right. So you're doing two things at once. You're trying to do the printed version of this one, and then the Mitre Square book you're working on as well.
It's three things at once. I'm also, believe it or not, I'm also starting the research for the Hanbury Street one as well.
Oh, okay.
But as I do this full time and I have nothing else to actually do, I squeeze things in without too much hassle.
Well, something interesting, Glitch, is a lot of researchers talk about is that they try to show temporally we have an increase in the amount of violence, which is not always the case, because if Polly Nichols was interrupted, then that would have started right at that moment. And then here's Mary Jane Kelly, she was indoors, so he had a few hours. Yeah. But yeah. So it's interesting that a lot of people would automatically do it from each each particular murder. So you do the next one with Annie Chapman. So what do you think about that particular idea of an increasing amount of violence?
I think there is an increase in the amount of violence. The only one where there's not is the Elizabeth Stride one, and that again, I think most people accept that if there is a Ripper murder, and that's not 100% certain, I think. But right. If it is, then he's interrupted. The killer is interrupted.
Right.
I'm pretty sure I know who he's interrupted by, and that fits into other theories I've got about who the killer was.
Which will come later, right?
Yes, there may be a suspect at the end of this at volume 7. We're probably looking at about 14, 15 years' time for that.
So I'm going to have to find a lot more stuff on my guy so you can use that stuff.
Good. No problem.
What do you think the biggest misconception about Jack the Ripper is in the general public?
That he was well-to-do, that he was possibly a member of the royal family, that there was a massive establishment cover-up. I think that's what you hear all the time. I've got friends who are tour guides. Unfortunately, there's no tours at the moment, but you go on their tours and you hear the general public saying this over and over again. He was a toff. He was a royal. You go on Facebook, you see it over and over again. You don't see it so much on the specialist sites like Casebook and Facebook, Casebook and JTR forums, but on general public sites, those are the main misconceptions.
And what about him being a doctor or someone that was like medically trained?
This is an interesting point. It depends on who you listen to. I mean, the doctors at the time seemed to be equally split. Phillips definitely believed he had medical skills. Bond believed he didn't. Some of the others were edging their bets. It depends on whether you think he shows skill or not. Now, my previous employment in medical research gives me an insight into this to some extent. And I see no skill whatsoever in any of the cuts at all. Of course, I'm working on the fact, I mean, people will argue then, but what about Edo's with the kidney? I will argue that is slash and grab. He finds it by accident and just takes it. Other people will argue, well, that's not possible. Well, that's down to people's opinion, isn't it, basically? We don't have the facts to let us make a decision. I don't think there's enough there to argue that he's got any skill at all. At the very least, he may have some, he may have some basic anatomical knowledge from cutting up animals, perhaps, but I'm not convinced of that either. I don't think there's any knowledge or skill is needed to do what the Whitechapel murderer did. I'll say now, I don't like calling him Jack the Ripper at all, personally. I prefer to use the term the Whitechapel murderer. I just don't feel comfortable using the term Jack the Ripper.
So when you say he just, it's kind of a slash and grab, do you think there's two things. One, didn't he have some sort of idea of what he was going for? Or do you think it was just, you're saying it's complete accident?
I would say that the cuts are not surgical cuts. He's not called the Ripper for nothing. The cuts, the external cuts, it's a stab, a rip, another stab, a rip. They're not continuous cuts, any of them. They're meandering cuts. I think he obviously was driven by the female sexual organs in the genital area. And if you cut down there, those things are quite obvious. And you just take what you see, basically.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And was the same person who attacked Emma Smith. When Emma Smith looks like she had something inserted into her, the match of a murderer could have done the same to his other victims. In which to locate what he thought was, you know, privates of women's parts, basically. I don't think he was actually searching for anything intentionally. I see no evidence that he's searching for anything intentionally. We have comments from, don't we have a comment in the Lancet that organs remove with one sweep of the knife, but they actually weren't. So much was exaggerated and people get these ideas. A good one is the Lusk kidney. How many times have we all heard that there was 2 inches, that the renal artery is 3 inches long, and it was 2 inches and one bit, and 2 inches left in the body and 1 inch left on the kidney. In fact, it's pretty clear from Dr. Oppenshaw and from Dr. Brown that there were no attachments on the kidney. It had been trimmed up. Yet this was made public by Major Smith of the City Police, and it's been repeated time after time after time as fact, and it's just not. It's mm-hmm. pure invention. Also, you know, they said at the same time that it was a woman's kidney of 45 years of age. You couldn't tell that, and it's interesting that the very next day the doctor, Dr. Oppenshaw, and the hospital released a press release discrediting what the press had said the day before they'd actually said. But that's not made public. That's not given out in any of the books or any of the sites. People just hear this, oh, this woman's kidney, the right age, blah, blah, blah.
Well, that kidney came with a letter. What's your opinion on all of the letters involved with this?
I wouldn't say they're all fake, because that would be... I never say anything's 100%, but I'd say 99.999 of them are fake. There's always a remote possibility that a letter somewhere was written by the killer, but I'm not sure of it, and if I had to put some money on it, I'd say none at all, personally.
Okay.
But I hate going 100% with anything. I hope you understand what I mean.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I always do this same thing. Speaking of letters or writings on Goulston Street, I don't know if we're going to get too far. I don't want you to kind of reveal anything in your next book. But,
no, that's okay.
What do you think? How about that? What's your opinions on the Goulston Street discovery?
This is another one of those where I think it's split 50-50, isn't it? Or perhaps 60-40 as to whether or not the writing is linked to the murders and linked to the April or not. I go through spells where I've been very strongly, it's got no link at all. Now I'm slightly more that there may be a possible link, but it's not clear, and it's not clear what it meant, and we're not even sure the exact wording, because different officers took it down differently. We're not even sure the exact location where it was. It varies. I mean, we're given a vague description where it was. And there's even some debate about the size of the fetters. Should that be interpreted as 3/4 inch, or should it be interpreted as 3 to 4 inches? So all these things that are unclear. My personal view at the moment is that they're probably not linked, but I wouldn't be surprised if they are, and I'm open to an argument that they are linked.
Okay. It's interesting about that. So what's happened is, after in Mitre Square, after Catherine Eddowes was murdered, a piece of her, was it apron, was found, bloody apron was found at Goulston Street, and right above that or near that was this writing. And so that's what we're kind of talking about. And I think there's some question is, let's say the possibility that the offender was a Polish Jew or something like this was in a Jewish kind of background, right? And that the writing was kind of hinted at that.
Yes. I mean, some people would say that, I've heard it said that if the killer wrote that, then in fact, why is he pointing the finger at his own community if he was a Polish Jew? My view is he's gloating, perhaps. If it was, you can't tell. There's no way of knowing what was going through this person's mind if it was written by him. Far too often we try to assume that we know how a killer was thinking. We have no idea how a serial killer thinks. And what's logical to them might not be logical to us at all.
The thing that, you know, you're right. I go in waves on is it connected or not. At the moment, I'm a not, because if you just eviscerated someone and you're running away so you don't get caught, I'm not sure if I'd stop and write something on chalk on something.
No, I don't think I would. But again, we don't know. We're thinking as logical people. We're not thinking like the killer at all. But I'm with you at the moment. I'm still probably 60-40 against it being linked. But I'm open to any reasonable arguments that make a strong point. I just haven't seen any that are that strong.
There's one is Tracy Eanson is she's kind of championing Levy, Jacob Levy, as the offender. And one of the witnesses was a supposed first cousin, Levy.
Yes.
And so apparently.
Joseph Hyams Levy.
Yes.
It's quite interesting. I was talking to Tracy only an hour ago.
Oh, look at that.
Far away with your question, though, and your comment.
Well, what's interesting how Tracy, what Tracy says that his office was near there. So her idea was that maybe he went to the office, dropped off the organs, kept that piece of material that he held the organs with and dropped it off, wrote that, and then went to, I think, a block, half a block around was the some relatives or something to that effect.
Well, I can clarify all that for you quite well.
Okay.
The cousin was definitely a first cousin. That's been proven. Joseph Hyams Levy. He lived at number 1 Hutchinson Street, which was 100 or so yards down from Jacob Levy's butcher's shop in Middlesex Street. It was on this same road, though it had a different address. He was a corner house. Galston Street, Wentworth Buildings, where the apron was found, the writing was found, although not in the exact block, Jacob's brother, Isaac, was living in the block next door.
Ah.
Yes.
Gotcha.
So there's lots of links there, and there's, you know, if you could stretch it. I mean, I'm a great believer in the Anderson suspect, whoever that was, be that Kosminski or somebody else. You could push it.
The Polish Jew theory.
Yes, you could push it that Jacob Levy is Anderson suspect. It's pushing it too far, but that's
right. Well, one of the things that I think Tracy talks about is that when, especially with the Anderson suspect, when the idea, I think Swanson and Anderson talked about going to that home that the Jewish witness refused to eyewitness. But I thought that Swanson said Kosminski.
He does say Kosminski specifically. And I was talking to Tracy about that earlier on, because that's the stumbling block for Levy being an Anderson suspect. Of course, okay. One thing we have discovered, we discovered it a long time ago, is that Joseph Hyam Levy, the cousin, was friends with a Martin Kosminski, who was a furrier. Now, we know Martin Kosminski doesn't fit what is said about Kosminski, but he may have had brothers who did. And in Adam Wood's recent book on Swanson, he sort of discusses that and looks at that possibility. Not in great detail, but it's mentioned.
Okay.
So there's a possibility that they're all interconnected in some weird way. I think we're not far out on whether it's Levy or a Kosminski. I think we're not far out. I think we're in the right ballpark sort of thing. Which,
Al, you're going to have to get. So, Al, you're going to have to get Adam Wood on the show.
Well, yeah, Wednesday.
Okay. So funny, Steve. How coincidental that you're talking to Tracy an hour ago, and we're going to be interviewing Adam in 2 days.
Yeah. Well, Adam's book is really good. I've read it all. I gave him my critique of the relevant chapter. I agree with much of what he said. I have no problem with a lot of what he said. Some of it I disagree with, obviously. But, it's well-reasoned and well-argued.
Well, I think that's the cool, great thing about, so everyone can hear this, is the amazing, to me, it's the amazing amount of research and the scholarship that goes involved with all these details. I mean, it's really, to me, it's exciting to work at this.
Adam's got so much work gone into that. It's taken him 4 or 5 years. He's got vast number of references in the book. I will just add, he hasn't got as many references as Inside Buck Rowe's got, but
that's right.
Oh, there you go. Wow.
His book's bigger than mine. His book's about 70 pages longer than my book.
Gotcha.
But I'm a great fan of Adams, basically, so I think he's a decent guy. I think he's a good researcher.
Yep, and he helps us out with the Ripperologist magazine, and so we
he
can
does. Get... He does.
Yep.
So where do you think it's all going to go? Like, at the end of the day, are we ever going to really zone in and figure out who it was?
I think some of us already think we know who it was. I'm not talking here about the people who just come into the subject, write a book and disappear. I'm talking about the serious researchers such as Mike, me, Rob House, Tracy. We're going to be around for a long time. A lot of us are I'd say 90% convinced that our suspect is the right suspect. Whether we have a proper answer, unless we find something completely incriminating, I doubt it. We're always going to be able to argue against whatever anyone else says, basically. Everything is circumstantial. The thing for Anderson's suspect is we get two police officers mentioning the same person. We then get McNaughton also mentioning same individual as Swanson mentions. You get Little Child acknowledging that he's heard of Anderson's theory. So we know that that theory was circulating around quite early on. Whether it's accurate or not, we don't know. I think Swanson and Anderson believed 100% that they had the right man as their suspect eventually. But I don't think they came to that conclusion until round about 93 or 94. That's 1893 right. or 1894.
Right.
I don't think they were thoroughly convinced even when their suspect had been locked up. It was only a year or so afterwards they convinced themselves. I think they were probably about 75% convinced when the guy was locked up, but not fully convinced.
Right. You know, but that matches that 93-94 because here is Little Child retired in 1893, and his first comment was, I have not heard of a Dr. D. So you could see that things were happening right around that time.
Yes. I mean, if you look at Anderson's writing, in 1889, 1890, he's not certain. By 91, 92, he's hinting that he's got ideas who it is.
Mm-hmm.
And by 93, 94, well, by 95, 94, 95, McNaughton's actually putting names down. The memoranda is one of the strangest documents we will ever see. And we could do a whole program on that alone, basically. It's a very weird document.
Yeah.
Can I, I may be causing some trouble, I don't know, but when you get books like the big published books, like Patricia Cromwell mm-hmm. and stuff, where they're in every major newspaper because mm-hmm. of their publisher, you know, saying... you know, the Jack the Ripper solved and
yes.
all this stuff. And the huge promo push, like lots of money.
Yes.
And they put the book out. It's number one. It does so well for a year or so and sells thousands of books. And it's and the reason what I'm getting at is when this happens, I find myself going to places just in public life before the corona thing. Mm-hmm. And people would just say to me, oh, so they solved the case. So they buy into it because they've seen it in the paper. It's in the New York Times.
Yes.
It's wherever. And so
like
they
the DNA. This.
Yeah, right. So all of a sudden, it's solved, isn't it? Didn't they solve it? And you get these questions because they know I write true crime. And I go, well, no. And so what do we do with that? And is that helping?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't help. I mean, as I've pointed out, I am basically an Anderson suspect person, which equates to Kosminski, let's say. I've had, for the last 3 or 4 years, and particularly the last year, loads of people saying, oh, it's been solved, isn't it? It's Kosminski. The shawl proves it, the DNA. It's nonsense, right. Quite honestly. Complete nonsense. I know at least 4 or 5 well-known Ripper researchers who've handled that shawl. So their DNA is there as well. I could name them here, but I won't.
No.
But I mean, well, the shame is that people read this because it's in the press, it goes in the press, it goes on television, and people take this as being factual. In Inside Buck's Row, I take great deal of contention with the documentary I mentioned earlier on Lechmere, because basically it, how do I put this nicely? It doesn't always give an accurate picture of what happened. For instance, right. It actually portrays Robert Paul walking up to Lechmere, and Lechmere is bending over the body, kneeling over the body of Mary Ann Nichols. That just didn't happen. It's not my view. That's what Robert Paul says himself. And yet, when you contest this with the people involved in the documentary, they say, oh, it doesn't matter. It's just a presentation to give people an idea. But it's a visual medium. And if you're going to not give the truth, what is the point of making it? And the same happens with newspapers. In Britain, it's the Daily Mail a lot of the time publishes stories about Jack the Ripper. And it's probably been sold with 5 different people in the last year, according to the Daily Mail. It's as simple as that. They don't help the case. They make research. They don't actually affect us serious researchers, other than if we're on Facebook, etc. Some of us will spend hours rebutting some of these silly theories because we feel that we have to, because we feel the general public should have a genuine view of what's going on, not the hype produced by big publishers or newspapers or television.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, because I just noticed, I don't know what's going on in the UK, but in Canada, where I am now, and the US, we're getting inundated with all these crime shows, you know, like all these production companies are making them because of the big love for it. Mm-hmm. And you see this stuff, all these shows that, you know, the Zodiac's my grandfather, the Zodiac's my uncle, and you get tons of them because they just want to get anything true crime on. Doesn't really matter if they don't have And so I'm getting that with Jack the Ripper too. Not as much as Zodiac lately, but I see a lot of these shows and they're just really not very good.
No, well, the number of people who have been on in the last 18 months on Facebook and some of the other sites talking about H.H. Holmes. And that's the classic. that's the classic show, isn't it? His great-great-grandson believes it's him. And there's no evidence at all in, how many programs was it, 4 or 5? There's no evidence at all in any episode. None at all, other than, I think my grandfather was the killer. And that's it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And I've had him on the show, and I've talked to him. And he really, really believes this.
Like, yes, it's not, I know he believes it, but he's got nothing to back it up with. It's just a belief.
Yeah.
That's the problem. This is the problem between... There are people in Britain who've got connections to possible suspects. And again, they believe that their great ancestor may have been the Ripper. I personally don't understand why you want to actually do that. But some people do.
Right.
Well, there's a real in public right now. I mean, with the whole social media aspect to life, there's a real need to be popular, I guess, or famous, and you know, they're licking toilets to get on.
Yes,
you know, with the virus going around, they'll do whatever they have to get so many likes, and so it's kind of like that, and I kind of feel sorry for some of them, but I just don't know how real researchers like both of you guys and other people that do not have millions of dollars to throw at TV and commercials and newspapers. I don't know how that's going to get through to the general public. That's
all. It's probably not. I mean, Mike's actually luckier in that he's publishing proper books. He's got a publisher who publishes them for him. That helps to a degree with publicity. I'm at the other end of the scale. I'm self-published. I'm not looking for mass sales to the general public. I'm looking purely to... I do it, A, because I want to do it, because I enjoy it, and B, to try and educate people who are seriously into it, basically. So it doesn't really affect me as such.
You know, one of the things I was thinking, Al, too, is that my background is there's peer review with the physical sciences and paleontology. Mm. And so what I am trying to push for is this peer review with Paul Begg doing reviews and the Ripperologist. And you actually, Al, you're interviewing people like Steve and Adam and also Paul to get the word out to show. But I also think us researchers, we're always dialoguing with each other, ripping each other apart sometimes. And then, but I think it's all healthy. In a strange way, it's kind of nice to have the interest out there that keeps us going. So, you're right. It's like, it can get really nasty or just really fake news.
Yes. All I will say now is that, I mean, I'm admin on quite a few Ripper Facebook sites, and the growth in numbers wanting to join the groups in the last 3 or 4 weeks is quite astronomical. So obviously people with time on their hands looking to find something to actually do, and that's really good. It means we're getting the message out there, but unfortunately we're still getting people coming on talking absolute nonsense. And some people get very offended when you tell them what they're talking about. It's nonsense. You tell them in the nicest possible way, and you don't use the word nonsense. You just try and tell them they're mistaken, that's not true. And all they come out with is, my opinion's as valid as yours.
Yes, yes. But that's one of the comments, though, I wanted to make about you, Steve, is that you're very patient with these people. That not everybody's very patient. Sometimes I'm not that patient. So that that's a quality.
I mean, I'm sure we both know researchers and authors who are on Facebook who are not patient at all with people. We're not going. I shan't name anyone, but I can think of several based in the UK who are not patient with people, and I understand why they're not patient with people. They've had enough of dealing with people who can't be bothered to actually go and do a little bit of research even. But you've got to understand that a lot of people coming onto sites like Facebook won't have done any research. They're not going to have done research. It's a subject that interests them. And I believe we got a role to get them more involved, to try and get them into the subject seriously. And if we can get 2 out of every 1,000 who join actually getting into it and doing proper research themselves, I think we've been a success.
Well, so now how do we get your book? Now, so the listeners that want to pick up Stephen Blomer's book, what do they do?
Well, it's only available as an e-book at present. It's not on Kindle or anything because they take too big a share of the amount. You get it directly from me. Now, you can go on to Facebook and look for a page just called Inside Bucks Row. That gives you all the details of how to buy. The thing has got all the reviews up there and comments. The book is regularly updated. There hasn't been one since February, but when on volume, we're actually at second edition now, and it's second edition revision 4, I think, at present. It's been updated quite a few times since it was released in July last year, and it's substantially larger than when it was first released. There's a whole new chapter now on the lost public houses around Bucks Row. But if you don't want to go onto the page, the Facebook page, you can pay for it by PayPal, and the address is www.paypal.me/bucksrow, all one word, lowercase. You get options of either getting a smaller resolution file, which basically is all everyone needs. If you want the larger resolution file, you're going to be looking at it on a 25-inch screen sort of thing, or a 30-inch screen. At the moment, because of the virus, and because I know people are at home and people are short of money, I've reduced the price to £4.99. You get constant updates for life. You pay for it once, and any updates that are done, you get emailed a copy of the book. Basically, if you make a PayPal payment, you normally get the book within 25 minutes of me receiving notification of the payment.
Fantastic. Now, we're going to have that on our website as well, so listeners can just do one click or just find it that way.
I say, if they want to go and have a look at the actual page, there's a web page, there's a Facebook page dedicated to the book. And it's just Inside Bucks Row. It's an open page. Anyone can go and look at it. Anyone can make any comments on there that they like. It's got all the details about how to buy the thing, about the updates. It's got reviews on there. It's quite handy.
Great.
Fantastic. Again, our guest has been Stephen Blomer, and the book is Inside Bucks Row, Marianne Nichols, and Anatomy of Murder. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.